Yeah, we should probably. Now I have the record button on. That's the way to do it professionally.
Okay. Want to start over with your premise here?
Yeah. Well, I also wanted, I told you before, but since we weren't recording, I'll say it in the recording. Since theoretically people are listening, all the old episodes, 147 something episodes of Random Badassery are available for people to listen in podcasts for free. So when we make references to old shows, it's there. It's there for you and I to listen to, but I've listened to it so many times over the years, I don't want to hear it anymore.
Yeah, same, actually.
I'm like, oh, I remember that conversation too well. Why do I remember it so well? Okay, so Zettelkasten is what we're going to talk about today. Those are the notes I have in front of me, which is kind of funny to say since it is a little meta. Since Zettelkasten is a note-taking system, Zettelkasten actually means... translating from another language, it's not exact, but Zettel being note, Kasten being box, or slip box, or note case, or note container. So, I think what you had asked me before I hit the record button, you had asked me if I thought this was a note-taking system. Basically, that was, go ahead.
That was result-oriented.
Yeah, and I think it's. I would use the word output. Oriented in the sense that it was stumbled upon, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was made with an intention, but the natural result of using Zettelkasten is that you will write. So what I wanted to do before we go into that is talk about how you and I, and probably the rest of the world, because I think we all pretty much come from the same perspective on how to write, at least nonfiction. So what we were doing before I realized I hadn't hit record is you were about to tell me your process.
I always start with the thesis.
Okay.
I always start with the goal to be desired, like in the writing itself, and I work my way backwards.
So let's make this really easy on each other and deal with this in a more tangible. Give me a fake thesis so that you can walk me through what you would do with that fake thesis.
Wow.
Let me think. Doesn't have to be good. It just has to be. It could be fish have legs. I don't care.
More police means more crime.
Okay. So you decide. So when you have that, you decide, like, I want to write about that. I want to write about this specific topic. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's how you come up with a thesis, is you're like, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's your next step? What do you do after that? I'm going to tell you where I diverge as you go along so that we don't have to do this twice in a row.
I mean, I want to say that I start with... I want to make sure that my thesis is correct. So I always start with the, can I punch holes in my thesis?
So you start with research.
Yeah, I always start with research.
Okay, so then you collect... I do the same thing. So you collect a bunch of research... And then where do you go from there?
I analyze the research to see if my thesis is correct.
Okay.
So I typically research with a blank slate. Like I try to leave as much confirmation bias out of it as possible and just do pure research.
Okay. Now let's do a branch here. If you believe that it's correct, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Then the writing really begins. I'll write what I would consider to be an introduction, but it's more something that tells me what I'm talking about. Like my introductions are usually the hardest part of my writing.
Okay, and then I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say here, but just for clarity, if you find out it's not true, what do you do then?
Oh man, I start over.
You start over with a new thesis?
Yeah, I do.
So you would never write about the other thesis?
No, I would include that thesis in the piece of work that I'm the new version. I would include that thesis, but it would be inherent in my introduction to say something like, "I thought I knew what the answers were in this particular thing, but it turns out that after my research, I've discovered something different."
Like that. So if your research I'm in line with you on all this, but if your research confirms your thesis, then you mm-hmm. write from the perspective of the thesis, which yes. is which. So you write an argument. If it is disproven, then you write from the perspective of, here's what I just learned.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought. I think I do the same thing. I hadn't actually put that together. That's why I wanted to talk about this, because I think making some of these like simple assumptions that we're going to probably use in the rest of the conversation more tangible will make it all a little bit better to play with.
Gotcha.
So then you would, after you've got your introduction, at any point, do you do an outline, or what do you do then?
Yeah, I would outline kind of. I mean, it depends on what the subject is and what style of writing I'm going for.
Let's go with your fake example.
I would definitely outline that one because you need statistical data.
Okay. So you're gonna pull, so that's when you start pulling your notes in and arranging things. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And then here's what I would do after that. I'd have all that. Then I'd start fleshing it, mm-hmm. which usually involves rearranging stuff and like, oh, you know what? This belongs in this section. This belongs in this section. And then the rest is just polish, 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 polish.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I think that's pretty much the way most people learn how to write, because I think that it's what's taught. I say, I think, in the sense that up until the time that I went to school and you went to school, that's how we were taught to write. Mm-hmm. I assume everybody else is still taught the same way, because I don't know a competing theory until Zettelkasten. So essentially what we're approaching it, we approach from the perspective of, here's an idea, let me prove that idea or disprove that idea, mm-hmm. and then let me convince other people of my idea.
Yep.
So it's almost from a legal perspective. Mm-hmm. When we write, we're writing from a perspective of an argument.
Yeah, sure.
It's very interesting, because it seems like, I think we'll have to weigh how you, obviously I already know about Zettelkasten, so I can't do this to myself, but I'm curious to weigh what your opinions are now and then after. Mm-hmm. So how, on a scale of 1 to 10, how logical is that as a way to write something?
Based on the rules of logic that I've used to write my entire life and the rules I was taught, it's pretty damn logical. I'd say it's about an 8.
Okay.
Because I don't always write that way.
I would probably even, before I knew about this, I would probably even give it higher, just because I couldn't think of any other way to do it. Other than the, there is one other way, which is the worst way to write something, which is just stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. and then keep trying to fix it.
You never get disastrous. Anywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or it takes way the hell longer than it needs to.
Yeah, it's not good.
Sure.
And even to apply this briefly to fiction, I found the same thing. I used to think that approach of the, what I would call the chaos school, mm-hmm. was applicable to a fiction, and that outlining and all that stuff wasn't needed. But then when I started working on the novel, I realized, yeah, you do have to plot an outline first. Mm-hmm. Because it's the only thing that holds it together. I'm sure somebody out there will argue with that, but whatever. They're not here, so fuck them.
Sure.
Okay, so Zettelkasten. Now that we have that out of the way, this will be interesting. Because this, I think I've used the term blows my mind lightly, but this almost literally blew my mind. Because it just, it flipped things over in a way that it's like you realize all of a sudden that you've been walking on the ceiling your whole life.
Hmm.
And then after, you know, like when you see something, you know, like those pictures that look like, there's the one that looks like a rabbit, but then if you look at it another way, it looks like a duck.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at it, all you see is the duck, and then finally you're able to see the rabbit, and then all you can see is the rabbit, and you can't find
all
the duck.
All you can see is the rabbit. Yeah, 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 sure, sure.
Or like that, the dress, in air quotes, the dress. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Whether it was blue or gold or whatever, I could only mm-hmm. see one. And as much as I tried to see the other, I could not see it. But I feel like if I did see it, I would never be able to go back.
To unsee it, yeah.
And that's how I feel about, after I learned about Zettelkasten. So I briefly mentioned the roots of Zettelkasten, but at the time I couldn't remember the details. Now I actually have the details in front of me. The guy who came up with it was Nicholas Luhmann. So I was correct with Luhmann. I just couldn't remember his first name. Mm-hmm. And Nicholas Luhmann has a very interesting story in the sense that he, I believe he was the son of a baker. And he went to law school and studied to become a lawyer. And then when he came out, instead of becoming a lawyer, he chose to go into to become a public servant. Mm-hmm. And while he was a public servant, he was, I guess he'd always been an avid reader his whole life. Obviously, he's going to law school. He was used to reading a lot and an avid note taker. And at a certain point, he looked at his notes one day and he was like, I've had this feeling myself. What the hell am I doing with all this? I think in one episode of the old show, I actually talked about how I used to copy my notes into digital note-taking systems. And then I just stopped one day because I was like, when am I ever searching for this?
Sure.
Why am I putting this in a place to search for it when I'm never searching for it? And he came to that same point where he was like, what is the purpose of this? So instead of stopping doing it, he decided, let me think about this. Is there a way that I can do this differently? Instead of these sheets and sheets of paper that I'm never going back to, is there a way I can do this differently? And I don't know if he had slip boxes around his house. You know what a slip box is?
No, I have no idea what that is.
Remember libraries when they didn't have computers? You remember those boxes where you had to pull the cards out to find where the books were?
Oh, that's what they're called? Okay.
Yeah. So those are library
slips. I never knew
slips,
what the name was.
And those are slip boxes.
Okay.
So I guess they were about 3x5. I think they were a little smaller than 3x5, but 3x5, they had bigger ones. If I remember correctly, his were 4x6 because they say that the sheets he was using were half a sheet of paper. And if half a sheet of paper is 8.5x11, half of that is 4x6 approximately. So he had these 4x6 slip boxes. And he decided, instead of putting these on sheets of paper, what he was going to do is he was going to put his notes onto these cards. But the cards could only have one idea per card. So instead of here is a sheet of paper or several sheets of paper on Howard Zinn's History of the American People, it's here's one sheet or one slip for this idea. Here's one sheet for this idea. And so every single thing, and they had to be complete sentences. They had to be, I think it was between one sentence, had to be one sentence minimum and less than a paragraph. So it had to be simplified and it had to be something that he would be able to understand later. And it had to be a complete idea. So in order to make these cards, first of all, he's already setting up the premise of I have to do some thinking. Before I take it. So he's taking note taking from this passive thing and making it more active. So he starts putting them in there and then he starts realizing because they're separated like this, the advantage is instead of grouping things by the book or by the author, he can start grouping things by ideas, by topics that are related to each other.
Okay.
So maybe you read 20 books, but in those 20 books, you run across four ideas about law enforcement and the effectiveness of numbers or the ineffectiveness of numbers. So what he would do is he'd start grouping them like that inside of the boxes instead of the other way. And in the bottom, he had a numbering system. I'm not going to go into the numbering system. It's very simple, but also very elaborate because it's an oscillation between numbers and letters. But essentially, what he was trying to replicate was like the library. You know how like the library numbers have the weird Dewey Decimal System numbers? And the reason those numbers are like that are so that when a new book comes out or they receive a new book, they can put it where they want it on the shelf, even though those are already numbered.
Yeah.
You know, because
so they can logically group them together. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So like if you have book one and book two, and then the next book is supposed to go between those, then it's book 1.5. Et cetera, et cetera. So he devises a system where he can start doing that. And then what he also starts doing is he starts realizing that even though these are grouped over here, well, I'll use your example again to keep things tangible for you. I have these four that are about law enforcement and numbers. They may also relate, you know, like this one, card 11A is about Chicago, you know, mm-hmm. police department in Chicago. Well, I have this group of cards over here about the civic system within Chicago, Illinois. So that actually relates to those too. So what he would do is he would write the numbers of those cards on mm-hmm. that card. So when he pulled that card out, he could go, okay, it belongs with these four, but it also relates to here, to here, to here. So he started like that dot with the lines connected thing that we've talked about before, that matrix. Mm-hmm. He essentially created a system to be able to do that with index cards so that all of his ideas can be set together. And what he would tell himself is, before I put anything into the box, I have to sit down and think of all of the ideas that it's related to. That's a key part of his system. So you're forcing all these connections to come to the surface instead of letting things remain passive. So he devises this system and he just kind of starts reading what he's reading. He reads a lot of books on sociology. And I don't remember how it happens. I believe he's talking to someone who's a sociologist. And he starts telling this guy all of his ideas, you know, like things that his thinking has led him in his note-taking system. Just, he would call it his conversation partner because it was just flooding his brain with so many ideas. Mm-hmm. And this guy was like, you should be a sociology professor. These ideas they're brilliant. And he's like, well, I don't have a degree in sociology. And at that time in Germany, you had to have put forth, obviously you had to create a, what do they call it? Thesis? Yeah. You had to have, you know, published a thesis, and they had something else. I can't remember the term of it, but there's this other type of paper that you mm-hmm. had to do. And you had to do those as a bare minimum to be able to teach the subject. So he goes, well, let me see what I can do. So he goes home and he just grabs like a bunch of his note cards and he's like, I guess if I put all these together, these all fit together. So this is like a thesis. So like he puts it together in like a month, like some incredibly fast period of time. He just puts it together and he gives it to the dude and the dude's like, this is brilliant. So he goes in front and so there's this thesis and now he has to give a talk about this other thing that he has to do. And I told you this story briefly before, but he has to get up and he has to say, you know, like what is your field of study? You know, what are you going to dedicate yourself for your next project and how long is it going to take and how much is it going to cost? Mm-hmm. And he says, my theory, my next project is the theory of society. And the theory of society is like the theory of everything when it comes to sociology. He's like, projected time, 30 years. Cost, $0 or zero Deutschmarks. Mm-hmm. So he becomes a sociologist and he becomes a sociology professor. And from that day forward till the day he died, he was a sociology professor. In that time, he wrote 70 books.
Oh, Jesus.
And nearly 400 academic articles.
Wow.
And he completed, I don't know if it's all 70 of the books, but a certain group of the books, whether it's all 70 or just part of them, were his theory of society. And he completed it in 29 years and like 6 months. So he was almost dead on. And when he died also, he left behind 90,000 slip cards.
Holy crap.
It's incredible. Incredible story.
That's nuts. Wow.
Incredible story. Huh. So before we go any further, what do you think of that so far?
Man, I don't even know where to begin with that. That's insane. Like, I mean, that just... I mean, I guess it seems like work to me, but only because my brain doesn't work that way inherently. So, I mean, I would have to... It would be the only thing I ever did.
Okay, let's go into that a little deeper. Make me understand. Go deeper. What do you mean by you think that it would be... What are you feeling? Give me more words.
Well, I don't organize that way. And so I'd have to... The first part of that entire task would be just learning how to organize that way.
How do you organize?
That's a good question.
Is that a way of saying you don't?
No, I definitely do have some kind. And I know it's evolved over time, but it's hard for me to really put a finger on what the actual structure of it is. I feel like I use note taking apps that way, like not the way that he's using them, but it's really hard to define that.
I'll explain mine to give you time to think about it.
Yeah, give me a primer here.
So obviously this is in flux. I keep talking about my note-taking system, my new note-taking system. I'm in flux. I'm moving from the way I did things to the way that I'm trying to learn from this. And sure, the app that I'm doing makes it very easy because it's essentially built very similar to this. So my previous, it would fluctuate depending on the app. You know, if I was using Evernote, obviously I would think a lot about tags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're using Apple Notes, there are no tags. You have to think a lot about your folder structure.
Yep.
But essentially, to boil it down, hierarchical subdivisions, file folders, mm-hmm, essentially.
Sure, sure.
No matter how you, even Evernote is essentially built on file folders. You go into Bear. Sure, Bear's using hashtags, but it's also using the hashtags as folders. Mm-hmm. Granted, you do have the ability to be able to add more than one hashtag to a note, so it technically lives in multiple folders, but it's still that type of thinking and organization.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, I think we all, to some degree, we build our systems around the tool.
Sure.
Makes sense because they have limitations or they have special features or whatever. So mm-hmm, I'm in a hierarchical place and I'm doing this stuff, I'm thinking like that, like, okay, what is the best way for me to collect this stuff? Okay, I read a book on, let's see, what book's in front of me right here. Okay, Outlaw Book of American Essays. If I read that book, I'm going to make a note for that book. And in the note for that book, I am going to put whatever the hell I put in there. Depends on what phase I'm in too. You know, like, sometimes I'd be very quote heavy, so it'd be full quotes. Sometimes it would be just like me grabbing one or two, like, oh, that's a cool idea. That's a cool idea. But I think essentially what it boils down to is because of hierarchical structure and that type of thinking, I was a passive note taker. Passive note taker in the sense that I'm approaching things with no purpose and I'm structuring things with no actual purpose. Because, and I think that completely relates to the way that we talked about how we write something in nonfiction, right? We come up with the idea first, and then we do the research. So the research comes second, right?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if we are collecting information without a thesis, we don't know what the purpose we are collecting for is, because the purpose comes later.
Yeah.
So we just kind of have this, and I mean we as in most people,
mm-hmm,
this idea of collect it and then it'll be, hopefully one day you'll need it. It's a hoarder mentality almost, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, like this notebook in front of me. Here's a bunch of stuff in here. When I was writing these notes, I don't know if I'm ever going to need anything in here. But I'm archiving it. It's archival. Sure. It's there. Sure. It's there. I won't lose it. It's desperate fear of losing it too, right? And it's really easy to lose things in hierarchical note-taking apps, because if you never go into that folder and flip through every note, you might never see it. If you never search for something with the word that's in that note, you may never see that note again.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely possible, especially if you know you were like this guy and you had 90,000 notes. And the other thing about it too is it's not idea based, right? It's project based. You know, this book is a project. I have read it. Here's everything I need to know on that project of that book.
Mm-hmm.
So when I have an idea, a thesis, I have to do a lot of searching through my notes to find things that fit it. And that's not even including all the research I have to do that's not in my notes, right? Usually we would start in our notes and then we'd go, okay, well, that gives me 20%. And I think for me, the hardest part of writing nonfiction was always the research. Not to mean that the writing wasn't difficult and the organizing wasn't difficult, but the research was always the hardest part because that was the part I was least likely to get through.
Mm.
Which means it was the most friction. It had the most friction.
Sure.
Okay, so that's my basic. How do you measure against that?
I would say almost identical. I have a feeling it's identical because we learned the same systems when we were growing up on how to do these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I think we would be very hard pressed to find people who don't think about it this way, to be honest.
Sure.
The more, ever since learning about this, the more I see things about writing and note taking and productivity, even mm-hmm. online. Now that I see it through this lens, I'm like, oh, everybody sees it that other way. They mm-hmm. all have different slants on it and different, you know, it might be a different color, but it's still the same.
It's variations on a theme. Yeah.
Yeah. It might be green, but it's still a lion.
mm-hmm. Sure, sure, sure.
So what's interesting about this system is how, actually, let me look at this. What do I have written here? Okay, that is what I was going to say. I want to make sure that I'm not skipping something. So it seems like this system, to me, is focused more on the process of learning than the process of production. Whereas the other way is focused on the process of production. And we hope that learning feeds into that. And I think evidence of that would be that, you know, like I said, like I might pull all of my notes and find I don't have enough on the topic, mm-hmm. the thesis that I have, right?
Yeah.
So the learning is incidental. You know, whatever I happen to learn up until the point that I have a thesis to do, a mm-hmm. hypothesis to test, is incidental. I may have enough to do a whole piece on it. I may not, because I don't know, right?
Yeah.
So the focus is definitely on production. Whereas Zettelkasten, that's why I was like hesitant to say that at the beginning, because I actually think it's the opposite. It's essentially collect stuff, put it in a way that the ideas themselves become apparent. So if you are taking notes like this, and you are, we'll say you have 9,000, you have 1/10 of what he had. You have 9,000 cards. So that's 9,000 ideas. It's very popular right now to call them atomic ideas. So you have 9,000 atomic ideas. And you're, whether you're doing it like him, where they're cards, where they're physically grouped together, or you're using something that has hashtags and you're hashtagging stuff, or you're using an app that works more along the lines of Zettelkasten, things start clumping.
And things start what?
Clumping.
Oh, clumping. Okay, got it.
Or clotting even. They start to collect. And all of a sudden you realize, you're like, oh, look at this. I have 100 notes all about this idea. Well, guess what? It's already written.
Mm.
You know, like, all you have to do is put them in order and write the words. All the work's already done.
Yeah.
And that's why he was able to write 70 books and 400 academic articles, is because all of the work was done during the learning process. And the reason that's incredibly valuable, I think, is because you're doing the work when you are most acquainted with the information. Whereas the way that you and I have learned to do it, we are doing the work when we least know, you know, unless it's something we just happened to learn the week before, but most of the time we're pulling out notes we haven't seen in years.
Sure, sure, sure.
We're completely removed with the person that learned that. So if we didn't word it correctly, sometimes our notes are useless.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. That's definitely true.
So if you're doing the work at the time that you're learning it, then it's done. You know, like you're doing the finishing touches. So for him, he could just look back and go, oh, look over here. I have a book. And then just write that book real quick and then be like, oh, look at that. Over by the coffee table, another book. What's this under my pillow? Another book. You know, I feel like it was like that for him. They just start collecting. And I can say from the small experience I've had, it's true. And it, and what's very surprising about it is they don't collect. You end up with research, or you end up with notes on topics you maybe thought you never would write about. Because
interesting.
Especially if you're like me, you read a lot of different kind of books. All of a sudden, you look over and you go, wow, I was never interested in gardening, but look at this. I have like 30 notes over here about gardening and hydroponics. And I don't have to do any work to write that because I already learned all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, you're like, I'm writing about hydroponics today. How cool.
I still feel like there's a part of the logic that's missing to me here. Okay, so let's take a step back for a second. So he has these collections of notes that can then be compiled. So explain to me then, from the process of actually taking notes, how that's different from how we take notes now.
Okay, so let me pull out. I'm going to pull some actual notes. I think that'll make it easier for you.
Okay.
Give me 1 second to find something. Let me find a book. Just any book, but I'm just searching in my... All right. Let's try that. I don't know if this is going to connect to anything. Okay, good. Not a ton of notes. So I have notes on the book called The Courage to Be Disliked, which is about Alfred Adler and his psychology. Mm-hmm. Now, these notes were written before I learned this system. So this will be a good way to compare them. So what I have here is I have 3 quotes directly from the book, and one of the quotes has what may be a clarification underneath of it of some sort, or a further addition of the idea within the quote. So I have, let's just deal with this one note. No experience is in itself a cause of our success or failure. Okay, let me read that again. No experience is in itself a cause of our success or failure. We do not suffer from the shock of our experiences, the so-called trauma, but instead we make out of them whatever suits our purposes. We are not determined by our experiences, but the meaning we give them is self-determining. Okay? So, in the old system, I'm done, right? I copied down the quote, I'm done.
Yeah.
So maybe one day I'm going to be writing something and I'm searching for the word trauma. Boom, this will come up. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. Mm-hmm. Maybe one day I'll be searching for self-determining and boom, this will come up. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. Okay, that's the old system. The new system, first thing I would do is reword it in my own words. Number one, to make sure that I understand it. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this previously. But then also, because if I'm rewording it, I'm already creating a part of a rough draft.
Sure.
I don't have to do something to make that fit in. It's already in my words.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm not plagiarizing because it's in my words.
I'm starting to understand now. Yeah.
So I can say, say my rewording of this is, there's no such thing but trauma. We create what we call trauma with our own mind. Say that's my rewording. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I've got that note there. Now, maybe I read another book that relates to this in some way. And so I'm not going to use the digital note taking system because I don't want to confuse you any further than you might be. I'm going to pretend like I'm doing these on cards. So I write that down on a card the way that I just said it.
Yeah.
And maybe on the back, I write the exact quote if I'm worried about that.
Sure.
And later I'm reading a book and the book is about trauma. And I remember this one because remember, the work is when you're doing it, you remember to connect things when you're writing the notes. So I'm writing down another note that's, you know, something like maybe I'm writing something from Tony Robbins about states. You know, like we choose our states. And I go, oh, you know what? That reminds me of Adler. So I've got the Tony Robbins card with, you know, my explanation of it on the back. I write the card number for this Alfred Adler idea. Mm-hmm. Then I go over, I grab the Adler card, and I write the Tony Robbins one. You know, the reference number for the Tony Robbins one. And I put mm-hmm. them in the places where I want. Maybe they're not, maybe in this case, they're not actually grouping together. Okay? Physically grouping together, that is. And say that process happens multiple times. I keep running across similar ideas. And I keep doing the same thing I just did there. All of a sudden, get to a certain point and I pull it out and there's like, I look on the back of this card, this Alfred Adler card, and there are references to 30 other cards. Mm-hmm. That's a very clear sign to me that I have something to write.
Sure.
Because there's 30 things connected. So then what you do is whether they're grouped together or not, you pull those 30 cards and you put them down and you look at mm-hmm. it and you go, okay, what are they saying? You know, maybe some are contradicting the others. So you have to work out the logic of what you see in front of you and you go, okay, what's the thesis here? Now you've done the research. So you take the research and you go, now from the research that I already have, what is the thesis? And maybe the thesis here is what we believe to be trauma is an invention of the modern psychological or of modern psychology and is not based in real biological neuroscience. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the theory. And I have all of these cards that are already telling me that's true.
Okay.
So now I just stack them in the order that I arranged them, get in front of a keyboard, and write. And because they're in my own words, I can write them the way that they're written on the card. And then afterwards, I can just, you know, make a reference to who I'm referencing.
Yeah, you're essentially just linking thoughts that you've had at that point. You're not writing anything. You're just compiling it at that point.
Right. Well, sometimes they're my thoughts. Sometimes they're other people's thoughts, but they're my words.
They're your words. Yeah. Sure.
So I can say there's no such thing as trauma. And then in parentheses, I can say Alfred Adler.
Okay.
So it's my words. I'm not stealing it, but I am still going to give him credit for it being his idea.
Sure.
So now all of a sudden, I have a paper. And then all I have to do, really all I had to do was arrange, find the thesis, and mm-hmm. polish. It's already written. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's not written from a basis. I think one of the strong points about this is when we write the other way, we are too suspect, we are too subject to bias. Especially confirmation bias.
Sure.
If I decide I want to write, your example, I want to write about law enforcement, I go into it with a bias. And that's going to affect my research. But if the research is done with no idea of a thesis at the time, then my thesis is born without bias because, well, other than the bias of the people I've read, of course.
Yeah.
But sure. It's without my own personal bias. Mm-hmm. And so I can actually, you could even write an article that you're like, I don't necessarily agree with this, but the research says it's true.
Sure.
In the sense that, like, according to these people, this. Mm-hmm. And so you can still write something. Did that fill in the hole in the logic for you?
Yeah, it totally did.
Okay. So.
But then the tough part is then you have to rewire your brain to think about subjects and not about conclusions.
Yeah. Oh, man. I tell you something. When you start doing this, and I would say even the Zettelkasten is very important. But the most important part, and I've said this to you, I think, either the last episode or the episode before, the most mm-hmm. important learning tool that I've ever come across is that rewording things in your own words part.
Yeah. Sure.
Because it's moving the passive activity of highlighting into an active activity of making sure that I understand it. It's the Feynman technique, except I'm teaching myself.
Yeah, sure.
If I can't explain it well enough to put it on this little index card, then I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So when you start rewiring your brain, like you said, it gets crazy. I mean, like I sat down to, like, I do it like a daily review where I look at the notes I took last week, the notes I took last month, and the notes I took last year to make sure things are continually resurfacing. And I've been playing with some new techniques of trying to make more connections when I'm doing that.
Yeah.
So my previous process would just be, I pull those three things, those three days of notes up, and I just read through them, which is still good, totally a good thing to do. But I started this other thing where I was trying to connect them to open threads that I have. Mm-hmm. And so when I would do it the old way, it would take me about, depending on the length of the notes, 15 minutes max. But usually probably closer to like 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I don't have a lot of notes in here yet. So a lot of when I do the last year, a lot of things aren't coming up for last year. Mm-hmm. So I'd sit down in 15 minutes. Well, the other day I sat down, I think it was yesterday, and I'm like, okay, doing this and pull this up. When I got up from the computer, it was an hour and a half later.
Jeez.
Because I sat down and I'm like, oh, that connects to this, and that connects to this, and that I connected like 45 things.
Jeez.
And it wasn't this, it's not labor intensive, because something about it, and I don't understand, maybe it's because this functions closer to the way that the brain actually functions, but you're not sitting there doing laborious thinking. These things just pop up in your head. Mm-hmm. When you start thinking like that, all of a sudden the connections just keep happening. You're like, oh, that reminds me of this. Boom, boom. You would, my notes before, I would, you know, I start reading them and be like, oh, I remember this. But they wouldn't pop up in my head like that. They weren't in my working memory.
Yeah.
But something about this process keeps everything in your working memory, or at least accessible to your working memory. It's not in, you don't feel flooded. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Have you ever read Rework, the book by the guys who made Basecamp, Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansson?
I feel like I've read bits and pieces of it. I don't think I've read it all the way through.
One of the things that they talk about in there, it's like a very brief section, but they talk about the idea of byproducts. That every labor has a byproduct. Not every labor, but every production. Everything where you produce something has a byproduct. I think that's how we ended up with Vaseline. I think Vaseline, it's made from petroleum. I think it's a byproduct of making oil.
Yeah,
for automobiles. Mm-hmm. Or for example, Henry Ford. These are the examples, the example that they give in the book. Henry Ford notices there's all this scrap wood left after making the Model Ts. It's like, what are we going to do with all this wood? You know, it's like, you can't like build anything with it. It's just scrapped wood. So they started charring them and making them into charcoal briquettes. And that's how Kingsford charcoal was born.
I had no idea. Interesting.
From byproduct. So what this reminds me of is when I said that this is learning focused, the production is a natural conclusion because it's a byproduct of the process. So when you're learning in this active way, you just see things clumping. You're like, well, I mean, it's already like 90% of the way written. Why don't I just write it?
Yeah, sure.
It's a byproduct. So you can make 70 books and 400 academic articles because the hard work is already the thing that you're naturally doing, which is learning.
Yeah, I think it sounds daunting because I'm looking at it through the lens of the type of work that I would have to do in my current process to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels physically impossible in a lifetime.
I think it also has a lot to do with what you're using too, because I don't think that this would be, I think you could pull this off fairly well with Evernote because of hashtags, but certain in Apple Notes, I don't think you could do this, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Not in a way that's going to be effective, because I'm not going to go into my app because I want that to be a whole episode. I've already explained to you how that's going to be hard to explain. But one of the key parts of that app, which is a very popular thing in note-taking apps in general right now, is what's called bidirectional linking. So do you know what that is, or should I explain?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, I have an idea.
So like in Evernote, you know, like I make a note and I can say, copy the link to this note. Mm-hmm. I get a little app URL, right? And I can post that in another note.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if, for example, this Alfred Adler book is written by Ichiro Kishimi, is one of the authors. The other author is Fumitaki Koga. So in this note about this book, I could, if I had a page for Kishimi and a page for Koga, I could link them, right? So you could mm-hmm. go in there and if I clicked on that, it would take me over the notes for them. But yep. when you got over the notes for them, the only way it would go back is if I did the reverse and went and got the link for the
yep,
book.
Yep. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, sure.
But yeah. in a bidirectional linking app, when you link something, it automatically links the other.
Like it links it both ways. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So by typing in the page for Ichiro Kishimi, this appears on Ichiro Kishimi's page and Ichiro Kishimi appears on this page.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Okay.
So by having an app that can do something like that, being able to do Zettelkasten becomes so easy. You have to okay. think differently. You definitely do. And I don't want to get into the note-taking differences here because I want to focus on Zettelkasten. You do have to think differently. But once you start thinking differently, it changes everything.
Okay.
You feel like you're in... You ever feel like you're not living up to your potential?
All the time.
When you start doing this, you start realizing what your actual potential is because you're living in it. Because you're reading a book and you're going, oh, I got a few things out of that. And then all of a sudden, like you start doing your notes and you're like, holy shit. So many notes and so many words and everything links. And it didn't take any effort to do it. Because mm-hmm. when your brain starts thinking like this automatically, it just happens. You know, like I sit down and I'm like, I'll just write a sentence about what this guy's saying. And I do it. I'm like, oh, that was six sentences. And I linked to four notes. Holy shit. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It's really interesting when you start to go at it from the way of I'm creating overlaps in my synapses.
Do you think this will lead to you? Like, are you actively pursuing this as a way for you to change your writing process in general?
No, I think I'm just, I mean, I would be more than happy for that to happen. But I just started doing this because it made sense. And mm-hmm. it made my note-taking process that I've been doing for all these years feel like it had a purpose. Because for a while, I was just feeling like, why have I been filling these notebooks with shit that I never use? You know, like,
sure,
I have more notebooks than books I've written. Why is that? You know, like it starts to feel really futile. But then when you start living actively within the ideas, mm-hmm. all of a sudden that in and of itself feels like purpose because you're like, oh, I am actually getting, you don't feel like you're just reading. You're like, I'm actually getting smarter. Okay. I'm becoming more knowledgeable because yeah. when things start connecting, it's not the collection of knowledge that makes you feel intelligent. It's the connections that make you feel intelligent.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
When you can remember this thing from a book and relate it to this, you know, you remember, who is it? Thesis, antithesis equals synthesis. I remember, was that Hume? I think it might have been Hume.
Was it? I don't know. It doesn't matter.
I don't remember. Now I'm going to have to look it up now. But when you're able to start doing that just naturally.
Yeah, sure.
You're living in your own thoughts.
I feel like most people still don't do that.
No, because we haven't been taught it. We've been taught the exact opposite. We've been taught passive. It was Hegel, by the way.
Oh, Hegel. Okay, got it. I feel like I naturally had to learn that at some point in the last like 5 or 6 years. In order to make sense out of the world.
Clarify which, the connecting thoughts thing or Hegel?
Hegel, by okay. far. Because I feel like synthesis rarely happens for most people. And synthesis is such a powerful... Synthesis is such a powerful thing and it's so subtle because most people think of it as this grandiose, huge thing. But I think synthesis is functional on almost every possible level of life. Like I think about synthesis and communication, or the tying together of so many various different ideas and people and initiatives and agendas in order to synthesize them into something bigger and more complete. You know, like it's a fascinating idea to me to that concept of synthesis as you're describing it now is something that's been in my brain in a different form for a pretty long time, for probably very actively for the last 2 or 3 years and more passively for the last 7 or 8.
And I think that's the big thing here is like you've all of a sudden you've got your gears are engaged.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And things become more possible when you're engaged. That's why it feels so shitty to just be like collecting notes. And like, I think that's why people jump from app to app is because they're not getting from their notes what they actually want from them. Mm-hmm. So and I've done this before for sure. I know you have. You fool yourself into believing that a certain feature or feature set is going mm-hmm. to be able to accomplish. I know that for a while, one of the things we used to describe when we were talking on the old show about note taking apps was, I feel like I can't zoom out far enough. Like I can't get a big enough picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really good sign of being lost in your thought.
Instead yeah, sure.
of being engaged in it, right? Like I can't get a handle on this because it wasn't that we couldn't get the scope far enough out, is we didn't understand how things were connected.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
When you start to, and I will tell you for sure, there are points where, because this is so different, I feel lost, especially because the app that I use, which is called Roam, I might as well just say it, doesn't have a hierarchical structure. So the safety of being able to go to a list of all your files does not exist.
Mm.
And so there are moments where I feel like, oh man, am I ever going to see that again? That thing that I just wrote in there, am I ever going to see that again?
Uh-huh.
How do I know what I have? But what you start realizing, I don't know if it's because of that, it also forces you to be more engaged. But you start realizing that the things that don't surface, they don't surface for a reason.
Sure.
Because they're not connected to anything.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm reading a book and I read a really fascinating fact about, you know, why they put arch support in shoes, I might be fascinated about that at the moment that I read it, but I may never read about shoes or think about shoes ever again. So having that note surface is not really important because it's not going to connect to anything.
Mm-hmm.
It has no utility other than I was in, you know, it was novel.
Yeah, I, sure. Okay.
There's an interesting question too. Is like, how without something like this, do we separate what is novel from what is useful if we are collecting without knowledge of purpose?
Mm-hmm.
Because I do feel like a lot of the things I've collected in the past are novel. Like, that's neat. And
I feel like the answer is the answer to my question is in doing it. I was going to say, like, how do you determine the importance of something within the moment?
You don't. You collect everything in this.
Okay.
But you just don't have to worry about it because if it's not important, it'll never surface.
Got it. Okay.
So you don't like have to make it.
It won't connect. Yeah.
And it won't clog anything up because it's just a card.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not burying any other information. It's its own entity separate and everything else is its own entity.
Got so it. Okay.
It doesn't bury anything. So like I happen to have a thing about the arch support and shoes in there. So it's not in my way.
But it never ties back to anything and it never gets in the way of anything else. So it's
exactly.
It's almost irrelevant in its own. Not irrelevant, but it proves its irrelevance over time.
Right. The Zettelkasten system, I didn't even realize this till we talked about it, but it weeds things out for you.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's where my brain's going with it, is that it simplifies the process of determination as to whether something is critical or not critical, because if it's not critical, then it just doesn't show up.
Yeah. And the critical what the determination of what is critical is based off of two things: your interest in learning. So you're only going to get information from books you've read or documentaries you've watched. So whatever you've been interested, that's what you're feeding into it. And what clumps together?
Sure. Yeah.
So that's, I think that's why, like I said, our personal bias is completely removed from it. Other than like I'm reading about things I'm interested in.
Yeah. I mean, the closest to bias you have in your example is just you're interested in a subject.
Right.
Not a confirmation bias, as in like you want a certain answer. That's entirely different.
Now you could make that happen if you only read books with one particular perspective.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Of course, you're only going to get things that believe that if you only read things that give you that. But what I think is very interesting about it is it would be so much work to do it like that, that you'd probably give up doing it like that.
Yeah, that seems exhausting.
Yeah, because you'd have to be like, okay, here's my belief. I don't have a thesis, but here's my belief. And I'm only going to read things that confirm that. But how many times have you read a book that wasn't what you thought it was going to be?
Oh, probably about half the time, yeah.
So you'd have to like actively quit books because you didn't agree with it and throw away the notes.
There's a lot of people who do that.
Right, but you'd have to throw away the notes and pretend you never learned it. And it's just so much work.
Yeah, and sure.
And I don't think that, I mean, obviously you can, if you're reading a lot of polarizing opinions, you could end up writing a lot of polarizing things. But I think most of the people that are going to be drawn to this are not polarizing people.
Well, I feel like anyone who even tries to listen to this podcast will understand very quickly that it's about not the pursuit of knowledge, but the pursuit of the pursuit of knowledge.
It's about how does this thing we call a brain, how are we... Not how does it work, but how are we trying to make it work? You know?
Yeah, and I think that's the better way to describe it is, you know, in my conversations with you, the thing that always becomes most clear is that I'm trying to find answers to how to use my brain. Because I realize that in this moment when we're talking about this, there's two different things, right? There's the will that you have to control what your brain does, and then there's the brain itself. And I separate the two because one is conscious and one is not, you know?
Right. Well, that's why I think systems, tools, ideas, that's why those are the three big things for me, is because that's the brain.
Yeah. You're trying to find the thing that most matches your thought process in a logical way or enhances your thought process in a certain way.
Yeah. Like how do we use the brain? Oh, sometimes we use systems to manipulate or to get our brain to function. Sometimes we need tools, and sometimes just an idea opens us up.
Sure. And
like, this is a system, but of course it's also an idea and it's also a tool.
So yeah, like, sure.
If you get really philosophical on this stuff, I'm talking about them like they're three different things, but sometimes they're the same thing.
Sure.
You know, like a note-taking app, it's a tool. But because it's built with one way for it to be used, specifically in mind, it's also a system.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it started out as an idea.
Yeah,
Especially like Rome, the guys who make this app, they have a very specific idea of what they're doing and what they're trying to create. And I would say it's the same for most of the apps out there that are still run by the people who had the initial idea. You know, like I wouldn't necessarily put Evernote in that group because they've gone through so many different versions of leadership that I don't know about that. Or, you know, like OneNote. Eh, probably not. But Bear, yeah, Bear, definitely. You know, they're still run by the same people. Simple Note, Workflowy, all these things. So I just think it's very interesting to look at this through the perspective of rethinking thinking. That's essentially what this is doing, right? It's about writing, but this Zettelkasten is really about rethinking how you think and trying to find a way that actually works closer to how the brain itself functions. So before we go any further, let's do a measurement again. How logical is the current way that you would write a nonfiction thing on a scale of 1 to 10 now that you have learned a little bit about Zettelkasten? How logical? You gave it an 8 before.
I feel like it's a 6 just because I feel like a lot of things can still be done that way.
Of course. It's not that it doesn't work. It's just whether it's logical.
Oh, but, not to be combative about it, but it's not about whether it's logical or not. It's whether it's logical to do what you are trying to do. You know, because obviously like making soup versus, you know, cooking a steak is very different, but they both work. But the intended outcomes are very different.
Right. Well, I mean, if you were doing a legal briefing, mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of have to do it the other way because you do have an expected outcome.
Or if you're writing a law, for example, in my case, like that's, you know, like if you're writing a piece of legislation, you've got to start with your thesis and work your way backwards.
Yeah, you don't really want to show up for work on Monday when you're supposed to have, you know, like a new law about PG&E or whatever and walk in and be like, you know what? You know where my research led me? Uh-huh. Shoes are totally comfortable if you cut the toes off of them. Like, I just let my research lead me.
You'd be like, yep, you're fired. Thanks, but you're fired.
Probably don't want to do that. This really only works in the context of, for the most part, for creative pursuits. Creative being, in this case, the antithesis of practicality.
I feel like it's most logical because I'm trying to draw a distinction between the two, right? Like, what is the difference between one and the other? And I think one is where you have a determination as to roughly what you think your outcome is going to be.
Yes.
And one is where you don't.
That's literally what I was just going to say. It's all about outcome, I think.
Yeah, it's all about outcome. Sure. 100%. That makes sense.
When I think I worded it originally, one is product focused or production focused. Mm-hmm. The other one's mm-hmm. learning focused.
Yeah, sure.
So when I know that when your goal is production, you usually mm-hmm. have a product in mind.
Sure.
You know, whereas when learning is your perspective, as long as you're learning, you're doing good.
Yeah.
And everything else is a byproduct.
Interesting.
And I think with this type of learning, with this type of system, it really pisses all over the idea of the tortured artist. Because I think...
I've thought that idea has been crap for a long time. But yeah, carry on. Sorry.
Well, sure, we all think it's crap, but we all still live in it.
I guess.
Well, how many books have you written? I've written one, but it's poetry wouldn't necessarily count.
Yeah, none, but I'm not, but I don't consider myself a writer anymore.
I know, but what I'm saying is,
go ahead.
For people who take notes, mm-hmm. writing books is a natural byproduct, right?
Sure.
If you're using this system, okay? The reason we haven't written books is because it would be hard, because we'd have to do it the other way. Because it's the only way we learned it. So we define ourselves like I'm a book writer, I'm not a book writer. And what we're defining is, am I willing to take the effort that it takes, take on the effort involved to write the book? Mm-hmm. And that all plays into the idea of the tortured artist. Oh, I have to suffer to create this thing. But if you didn't have to suffer, and if you're already naturally taking notes, I venture to say that you would have written books by this point because they're already there.
They're already there. You're just putting them together. You're not writing anything. You're compiling them.
Exactly. And that's what I mean by it pisses on the idea of the tortured artist, because the tortured artist never comes into play, because the tortured artist is all based on the idea of this is hard. But what if it's not hard?
Sure.
What if the learning is the hard part? And then if you can begin to see it as the learning is the hard part, then books are easy. And and this is all theory. I can't say it for sure until I start spewing out books. And it's not easy in the sense that you can't start doing this and write a book next month, really. This is stuff that's going to happen years later.
Sure.
So you look at Lumen, right? 70 books over years because they would write themselves. It takes time because, you know, the book he wrote, the last book, we'll say book number 70. Mm-hmm. That one took the most work probably because it took 30 years, 40 years of reading.
I honestly think, though, that if you're describing it from the perspective that you are now, it was probably the easiest one because it was the one where everything was done for it already.
No, the writing part, but I mean the learning part was the hardest because it took the longest.
Yeah, sure.
Because that makes sense. That's just speculation because what I'm speculating there is knowing the little bit that I know about him, that 70th book probably had stuff that he just recently learned and stuff that he learned 40 years
way ago. Back. Sure, absolutely. At the very beginning, sure.
So the span of that book was 40 years of effort in learning, not in writing the book.
I can't even... Can you imagine writing something that spanned the scope of your entire lifetime?
Well, with this system, it'd be super easy because the things are just collecting, right? Mm-hmm. So before you had to make the effort to make that happen, right? I think the only way that you could do something like that is if from day one, you were trying to write book number 70 and the 69 that happened before were sidetracks and detours.
Sure.
But with this, every single one of them is just incidental. Still valuable, but incidental to the learning. It's a really, I don't even know if I'm even doing justice to this whole thing. Because it's something you have to experience to really, really get it.
Yeah, it seems like more of a theme than a topic for a specific episode. I feel like we're going to be talking about this for a while because I feel like I'm just starting to understand it and you're like halfway through understanding it.
Well, it's definitely going to be a theme in the sense that it's going to come up in the note-taking app on when I talk about Rome because how I use Rome is so much tied into Zettelkast. And it's almost in a way a precursor. Like you have to understand Zettelkast and for you to even begin to understand. And when we get into Rome, I'm not even convinced that I will be able to explain it to you. It's going to be a really fun journey of an episode of me trying to explain because I thought about it. I'm like, maybe I should just do like videos so you can see. And like, no, this is a podcast. I have to figure out how to do it verbally.
Sure.
And I mean, there is ways to explain things, but now that you understand the basis of Zettelkasten, a good percentage of it will make sense. You know, like you and I, the one thing I think we share is we like going against accepted things.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Like everybody thinks this and we all accept that. What if it's not true? You and I love that question.
I always start with bullshit.
And that's why I thought this was a good topic because it's like the way that everybody learns to write. What if it's bullshit? And turns out it probably for most things other than, like we said, legal arguments or something where you need a specific purpose, it kind of is.
Sure.
Because it makes, you know, like for me, why I said the research was always the hardest part for me because that's the part where I would drop off. Well, with that gone, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, sure. It'd be really interesting to revisit this conversation in a year.
Well, we should definitely do that. I think that what I think is interesting too is because the way that if we're going to talk about thinking, it's really all one conversation. These aren't individual conversations. It's just little pieces, but we're moving towards something, and that something is long in the future.
Yeah,
from where we are now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just understanding like this. Is just another way of viewing things that we've talked about before, about like when we talked about the hermeneutic circle, the idea of looking at things over and over again. That plays in here 100%.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
the idea of ideas surfacing and clumping together, that's the hermeneutic circle in action. And maybe that's the other problem with that idea of argument-based writing, is because it's coming from the perspective of linear learning, not cyclical learning.
Sure.
It's hurdles, you know? It's a straight line. It's a dash. It's not track and field.
Yeah. I'm trying to put that together. Like, that's a lot to process. I'm trying to put it together.
It is a lot to process, but we're also an hour and 20 minutes in.
So. Oh shit, are we really?
I can always, when you get to that, that's a lot to think about. We're usually at the end.
Yeah, because I feel like an hour is about the number of things that you can throw at me before I'm like, okay, I got to take some time with this shit.
Right, and it's understandable considering that, like, I'm coming in with notes and you're reacting.
Yeah, sure.
So you're trying to absorb and synthesize ideas and then come up with reactions to it. It's exhausting.
Well, not only that, but I'm, for the first time in our history of not just podcasting, but in our friendship, I feel like I'm coming into it so much more honestly now than I have been in the past. Like, if I don't know, I just tell you I don't know, right. You know? And you I'm genuinely making like a really big effort to, like, actually try to understand what you're saying versus assuming that I know what you're saying. That's a really big difference. And I feel like for most people with their relationships and their friendships, they do that a lot more than they realize.
Well, that's definitely something I remember from the older episodes, is I'd say something and you go, oh yeah, I know that. And then I'd talk about it further. I'm like, oh no, you don't know that.
yeah. And I feel like for the first time ever, like, I have moments now where I'm like, hey, Chad, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I think it's that it goes back to where we started when we started recording these ones. Mm-hmm. With the taking away the concept of an audience and just focusing it on you and I, you can't play that game.
Yeah.
Because it's not a show. You know, it's like it's a conversation, and the conversation dies if you're not completely honest.
Yeah, exactly. No, totally. So and, weird.
You know, it's like I can explain things from the notes, but then when I get to a point where I'm like, oh, well, I have no idea what I meant there, I have no choice but to say I have no idea what I meant there, or I have no idea what that, you know, was it the last episode? I'm like, so what the hell does this all mean?
But I love moments like that, though, because I love that in those moments, I feel like we're at our best. And what I mean by that is that both you and I are in a moment where we're like, okay, so let's dig our heels in and figure out what the hell this all means. You know what I mean?
And that's why, like, to me, like, there's a lot of podcasts that would take an idea in. This is not saying that they're wrong, but I'm just saying how I think you and I see things differently. They bring an idea like Zettelkasten. And it would be an educational format. Let me teach everybody about Zettelkasten. No, I'm bringing stuff in going, Lam, this for some reason is really interesting to me. And here's what I think about it so far, but there's something else there. And I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. There's always a little bit of a gap in anything I bring in. Because to me, it's like Zettelkasten. Here's where what it is. Here's why I think it works. Here's what I think it does. But I'm not sure I have all the pieces because I don't feel complete on that idea.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's what's interesting about it, because then we can work it out. And like you said, we might have to, you know, who knows? Maybe for some reason we'll say that this sticks with you. And all of a sudden you start trying Zettelkasten, you start researching more about it, learning how to do it, and you start doing it. And then in like 6 months, you and I are talking about it and like, we need to do another episode on Zettelkasten. And then we do
it. Yeah, sure. Sure.
Why not? Because that's how thinking functions. Hermeneutic circle. Of course, we're going to repeat ourselves. That's interesting. That should be obvious.
We're living that episode. we're like living the philosophies. That's so weird to think about it that way.
Well, I think that's fascinating, we're on a good track that we're at least talking about things that are bringing value to our minds. If we're living them, that means we're not bullshitting ourselves.
There's definitely a for lack of a better way of saying it. Like, I mean, I feel like I and don't take this the wrong way. I actually feel like this is a really positive thing, is that I feel like I have to be at my best to do these now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like the thinking cap has to be on, and I have to be sharp and I have to be focused, as opposed to before where I just took a lot of it for granted.
It's kind of like what I've been saying about Zettelkasten and the difference between passive and active. This show is active.
Mm-hmm.
Even me, like I have notes, but I do my best not to write a script. I'm just writing notes. So I've got to actually pull the logic together. I have to be here. I have to be present.
Yeah,
I feel like everything.
Well, I feel like every one of these episodes now is you and I standing at the top of a big hill, holding a sled, and we have to both consciously make a choice in that moment to go careening down the hill.
Are you Calvin or are you Hobbes?
I would like to be Hobbes. I feel like you're more adversarial than I am.
That's true.
Like, I feel like you like to blow stuff up more than I do, so I feel like you would definitely be the Calvin between the two of us.
All right, let me end this recording. We can chat for a bit.
I was going to say, that sounds like a good way to end it.
Yeah.